This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. I was just helping a friend who was looking for a psychotherapist. I have a psychologist friend who I trust, but she's become more of an author and media celebrity. So she gave me a list of therapists she trusts. And at the top of her list, I kid you not, is BetterHelp.com. And it's not just her. Check out the reviews at BetterHelp.com/reviews. There's 1.7 million of them, with an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5. That's because these aren't random online therapists, but vetted ones with at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of experience and certifications across a wide range of specialties. It's easy to get started. Just go to BetterHelp.com, answer a few questions, and get matched with a therapist based on your needs. Switch whenever you like if it's not the right fit. So see the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. It took a special company to convince me to do an ad for clothing, and that company is Quince. Imagine buying fewer, better pieces you love to wear all the time instead of an infinite scroll of crap. The best piece I got so far is a navy blue button-down shirt, the organic cotton stretch textured twill shirt, and it replaces like six others that got stolen from the laundromat last month. Feels different, fits different, and washes great. No crunchy crease in the elbows or itchy seams at the wrist, just soft structure, refined, casual details, no strings dangling. You'll see it in my next monologue. So buy less, buy better, look great, win jobs, meet lovers, organically, ethically, and at reasonable prices with Quince. Have a closet of keepers, not landfill. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/teamhuman. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/teamhuman. Team Human is an ad-free, listener-supported project made possible by teammates like Tyler Edgerly, Gene Combs, Mark Phillips, Net Gene, and Michael Reich, and hopefully you. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support to find the others who gain access to our Discord channel, my paywalled Medium posts, archives of my collected work, and conversations with luminaries like Timothy Leary, Terrence McKenna, and participation in our live Team Human salons in the Kibitz Room. Today is not a regular episode so much as a lovely bonus in our feed, an event I did for the release of Cyber Salon's new book of extremely short stories called 22 Ideas About the Future. I mean, as you know, I've been talking a lot recently about getting back to theater and graphic novels and, yes, fiction. Fiction has always been a guilty pleasure for me with so many urgent things going on in the real world. How dare I indulge in reading, much less writing, fiction? Don't I have a responsibility to understand and explain the realities of economic inequality, racial injustice, and climate change before engaging in fantasies of robots, space, or artificial intelligence? Perhaps, but after writing a couple of dozen nonfiction books and hundreds of articles, I'm not so sure that fact-based rhetoric is the best way to reach people or even to inform them. I mean, yes, I've gathered plenty of evidence for people who've already agreed with me to make their cases to others, and I know many of my readers have nodded along with what I've written, feeling confirmed and vindicated by seeing their opinions expressed for them in writing, maybe in a manner more fully formed than they've been able to articulate themselves. And it's an honor and a privilege to put words to our shared sensibilities. But still, I'm feeling like no matter how well I argue, I'm painfully limited in my ability to reach through to people who don't already see the world as I do. My facts, my insights, they don't penetrate closed minds. It's as if my premises just bounce off people's skulls and scatter on the ground unconsidered. If only I could get people to create a sliver of an opening to suppose something new or different, even just for a moment, if they would only consider the utterly implausible, even just for kicks, I know I could take care of the rest. And that's the beauty, the opportunity of collections like the one we're going to be talking about today. It's speculative fiction that does something very special to otherwise closed minds. It creates space for the novel, right? Even that word, novels, right? The novel. Just allowing oneself to pretend that something could be true is more than enough. We can't imagine something without at least entertaining that possibility. Speculative fiction is an invitation to speculate on fictional scenarios. And in the process, we reveal truths we may have hidden from ourselves. So while reality TV is busy generating dangerous fictions and creating closed-minded racist conspiracy theories in the process, speculative fiction exposes people to necessary truths they may never truly encounter otherwise. You can't read about the world after climate catastrophe without at least accepting the possibility of climate change to begin with, as well as a way out. If you suspend your disbelief in thinking machines for long enough to follow the story of a vengeful robot, you're ready to consider the impact of autonomous vehicles on the human environment. If you allow yourself to imagine a future without debt or credit, workers or bosses, hoarding or poverty, you free yourself to consider the inequalities embedded in our economic system right now. But beyond the specific subjects that speculative fiction can introduce to our stubbornly rigid minds, the process of speculation itself retrains the brain like a form of exercise. It stretches our imaginative capacity, making our thinking more porous and flexible and able to tolerate the surprising or absurd. Where reality addicts of all stripes can only envision a great awakening, apocalyptic comeuppance, or an endless cycle of repression, those who embrace fiction have the freedom to reject the inevitability of human suffering and envision alternative pathways, ways out, ways through, or just ways. What if? Speculative fiction, in particular, invites us to consider awe-inspiring new landscapes, outer space, inner space, living machines, alternative dimensions, magic sigils, and shared consciousness. And that experience of awe, it acts positively on the body and mind. Psychologists studying the phenomenon have found that even a brief moment of awe can help people act with an increased sense of meaning and purpose, turning our attention away from the self and toward collective self-interest. Awe even helps regulate our body's immune response, reduces inflammation as if engendering a less defensive, aggravated response to the unknown. After a few moments of awe, people behave with greater altruism, cooperation, and self-sacrifice. It makes people feel like part of something larger than themselves. Unlike traditional fiction, speculative fiction, it owes nothing to the standard Aristotelian arc that's characterized drama and story for the past two millennia. We're used to following the male hero up the inclined plane of tension into danger, and he eventually reaches a crisis that requires reversal and recognition. The poison is a weapon. The talent is a flaw. The goal is the problem. Then climax, catharsis, and sleep. And this same shape of striving toward a goal up the hill through adversity to the golden ring at the end of the journey, it's also characterized everything from Christianity and capitalism to Marxism and activism. We make change through ends justifies the means campaign. campaigns because it's the only story architecture we know. No pain, no gain. But the best of speculative fiction, it frees us not only from our personal reality tunnels, but from the tired narrative conventions that limit our approaches to innovation and collaboration, consensus and liberation. In this sense, speculative fiction is inherently revolutionary, or better, evolutionary in its purpose. Not only can things be different, but the way in which that shift happens must also be up for discussion. Every story is a theory of change, whether or not it rises to that occasion. I mean, try to imagine technological innovation without the specter of a business plan or exponential growth curve. What is virtual reality or even a metaverse when it's not obligated to breathe new life into a dying ticker symbol? Yes, Facebook, I'm talking about you. Where else but smart sci-fi and cli-fi can we speculate on the unacknowledged externalities of these business practices and the unforeseen impacts of the technologies themselves? Imagine what technological development might look like if it weren't already sitting on top of the operating system we call corporate capitalism. Dare we? So no, I will no longer apologize for my love of fiction and speculative and yes, science fiction, climate fiction, cyberpunk, and solar punk. In a world where nearly every experience makes us feel like we're being quantized for the benefit of an observing algorithm, we need ways of slipping between the prescribed values to the bizarre in-between spaces where life breeds and human thought mutates. Just because it's fun doesn't mean it's wrong. This is the work. This is the play. And so, with that in mind, here's an event organized around the book of short stories, 22 ideas about the future, for which I wrote the introduction. It's a panel with the people who made the book, Stephen Oram, Eva Pascoe, and Benjamin Greenaway. It was on Thursday, the 29th of September at Newspeak House in London. So please enjoy.
Hello, welcome everybody. Thank you very much for coming to the launch of our amazing new book, 22 Ideas About the Future. Very excited to be here and see people in flesh. That's a nice break from our post-COVID virtual reality. But we're not afraid of virtuality, so we have some virtual show for you for later. But we're going to kick off with an introduction to Douglas, who has supported our project and wrote the introduction to it. And it nicely coincided with his own book coming out. So we're hoping to get a little bit of conversation today about what you thought about our project, and we want to hear from you about your book. So welcome. Very excited to see you. And if I can hand over to Stephen, who was the editor on the book and did with Ben the grunt of the hard work, as we know, putting books together is pretty dumb. It's thrilling, but it's exhausting and irritating in the same way.
Douglas, hello. Loved hey. Your book, by the way. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. Lots of food for thought in there. I've got sort of just a few questions. I'll start off with one, which is just
that's
really...
Yes,
you'll hold it up again. Hold it up again, Douglas. Survival of the richest. It's absolutely
escape
brilliant.
Fantasies of the tech billionaires. Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of your book, which is great.
So just to sort of get into just sort of asking you a question, really just to sort of get the thing rolling, and obviously you'll take it wherever you want to take it. But so in the digital civilization that we found ourselves in, we're observed by algorithms when we sleep, ovulate, date, exercise, and our lives have been digitized to really sort of chew humanity and spit us out as zeros and ones for the benefit of fattening big tech, maybe. Do you think fiction is a way forward in which we can sort of reclaim humanity?
Certainly. I mean, the zeros and ones of digital culture are really consonant with the utilitarian values of capitalism, right? Which will look at human beings as, you know, even since the late Middle Ages, as cogs in the machine. And it requires human beings and the humanities and the arts or the spiritual, which are kind of the same thing to me, but it requires the arts to assert the value of the stuff that can't be quantized, of the stuff that's between, you know, between each quantum level, between the one and the zero. You know, it's Peter Thiel, one of my billionaires, you know, he's all about going from zero to one. Well, what about everything between zero to one where the human beings, you know, actually live? You know, what about the space between the ticks of the clock where human reality happens, which maybe remains unmeasured? You know, art is fantastic for acknowledging and recording and centering, or even, you know, privileging the non-numeric, you know, the stuff that can't be digitized or quantified. You know, so we have Francis Bacon to quantify every piece of nature he can, and the artists to do the other 99.9% of living experience. So absolutely. The trick is, I think, I was just thinking about this as we were starting, is what kind of fiction? You know, what kind? There's the guys in my book, the tech bro billionaires, are informed largely by science fiction. You know, their end of the world apocalypse scenarios are from, you know, Walking Dead or other. I wouldn't know if I call that speculative fiction, but fiction of a sort. And their solutions, their kind of techno-solutionist vibe also comes from fiction. And even I feel like most of the people I've spoken to look at the future like Ready Player One, where they're going to build a metaverse for people to have fun in while we live in trailer homes that are stacked a mile high in you know, horrible conditions. So what's that? But the kind of an oversimplified view, or using fiction to land on a very singular and certain future. But the art fiction, I think, as opposed to pure entertainment fiction, art fiction is not about answering questions and giving entertainment and finding pat solutions, but asking questions and opening things, right? You read one of the stories, even the 3-page story in this book, and you're left asking questions. You've been activated, right? The story is the beginning of a thought process that keeps moving. Whereas the kind of fiction that my tech bros are looking for is the fiction that gives them an omega point, you know?
Yeah, gives yeah, them absolutely. Yeah.
The thing.
And there's a kind of, so a little while ago, I was sort of pondering for myself, which I'm doing something around, which is what responsibility do sci-fi writers have? So if we are influencing people, influencing the future, giving people, like, what do we have a responsibility in? And you're absolutely right. Those, what I would describe as kind of cowboys and Indians in space, you know, the sort of, they're not really speculating. They're just changing the situation in which a very traditional story is told, the sort of the good, the evil, the and all that kind of thing, where hopefully, well, I think so, any of the books, the stories in this are, as you say, they're kind of opening up a space for discussion as opposed to kind of giving you that full thing and that end point as you were saying.
I mean, and I think that's true of fiction and nonfiction. You know, are we describing the figure or are we describing the ground? You know, there's a lot of well-meaning, say, climate nonfiction that focuses on the catastrophe, right? So they're focused on the figure. It's like Kubrick would say, you know, at the end of Dr. Strangelove, when he shows all the atomic bombs blowing up, he's saying, oh, look, you as a civilization, you're really concerned with that bomb blowing up. But nobody's looking at what are the conditions on the ground that are leading to a world where these people have all this power and these people have these bombs. So how do you write fiction that isn't, like you're saying, even speculative fiction that isn't just a translation of, you know, the Aristotelian heroic narrative that's used in every, and now we're going to, okay, so now we'll just do it in space, or now we'll do it in nano, or now we'll do it with robots. And it's like, no, you still haven't dealt with the guilt of having enslaved people for 300-400 years in your country. And now you're going to talk about enslaved robots. It's like, no. You're still not getting what you're missing, you know. So, and in science fiction in particular, because so many of us kind of nerdy tech bro white guys got interested in science fiction, part of why we're interested in it is because it's like, it's orderly and precise and clean surfaces and oversimplified, and you don't have to really think about, you know, women and brown people and dirt and soil and confusion and relationships. It's like, oh, a boy and his robot in space, you know. It's like, yeah, pure absolutely. Made for Musk, right?
And in your book you talk about the mindset and the people, which is kind of what you're saying there. And I wonder whether you feel that speculative fiction, maybe particularly this kind of thing, the short ones, is a, you know, do you think this can challenge that kind of mindset? Not obviously, like, who knows how many tech billionaires are going to read this?
A few, all of them,
good.
We'll make sure.
But in terms
they
of
can't
the,
read.
How that's trickled through to everyone's mindset, do you think this is a way of challenging that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I feel like these stories challenge that in form, function, and content all at the same time, right? It's very, I don't even know what to say. It's counter-egotistical to write a story that's 3 or 4 pages long, right? I'm only going to ask for 15 minutes of your time. How about 15 minutes to think like this, right? And then the stories, for the most part, don't do what people are demanding of their entertainment, which is always a form of dance, boy. You know, give me this thing, and when do I climax? When do I come so I can go to sleep? You know, crisis, climax, conclusion. It's like, okay, it's really short, so now it's just going to be a quickie. But almost none of these stories do the, you know, they don't give that, they don't, we can speak frankly, they don't wank the reader. Right. They don't. They bring the reader into a new ground. You go into this atmosphere of this story. You're forced to deal with all these questions. And then there you go. And then, oh my, you know, so it's almost like these stories, it's like 22 levels of tantra. Right. It's like you keep going. It's like, oh, now I'm in this place. Whoa. Okay. All right. Now this is going to stay with me a while. It's like, no, I'm not going to even read the next story now, because now I want to go out and be in this place, which is so different. Again, so the focus becomes on the ground rather than the figure, becomes the experience of this world, trying on this taste, this. How do I, you know, you take in a story like this and you end up kind of embodying it. It plays through you on it's only fiction can, on an emotional, atmospheric level. And then you process what's happening a bit differently for a while. And that's the fun of it. So it's really, it's contrary to the apocalyptic narratives. The epic apocalyptic narratives that most of these tech bros are adopting and are pushing on us.
I'm really pleased to hear you describing it in that way, Douglas, actually, because one of the goals of the project had been to develop and deliver stories that leave the reader engaging in the problem. So the fact that it's asking, the fact that it's there about engagement, the fact that it's there to get people involved in that policy, again, it sounds like some of it's working, which is good.
Oh, it's definitely working. And it's like, you know, I mean, Bertolt Brecht was dealing with this problem, right? He was upset that people are going into theater and they want these epic things and they want relief and then they're done. And he's like, no, I want to shatter that. So he still created epic plays, but they would end by saying, and you're not getting an ending here. The gods, you know, he has one where the gods come down, like a Deus Ex Machina actually happens. And the gods go, I don't know. I don't know what to do. And then it's like, oh, shoot. So, but you don't have to take us through that whole thing. You're accomplishing the same thing by going, okay, how, now this, okay, now that, okay, now this, you know, and it serves that kind of psychological function.
And I think both your introduction and Ava's preface to it helps set that up for reading the book, because obviously there will be people that will come to it thinking, I'm just going to read 22 sci-fi stories that I would normally expect. And although it will take them further than that, I think both the introduction and the preface help kind of move people into the right place. I'm encouraging everyone to read the introduction and the preface before kind of diving into their favorite author's story or whatever, just to get that sense of things. The other thing I'm wondering is, so in your Survival of the Richest book, you've kind of moved, well, tell me if I'm right here, you've moved from sort of conveying ideas, although you are conveying ideas, but it's very story-based as a book. I'm just wondering what was behind that decision. Was that a deliberate decision? Is there a reason for that? Have I got that right?
Yeah, it was a deliberate decision. It was partly, I mean, you know, my editor and my agent both said, your ideas are great, your polemic is great, but your stories are what have the traction. Your stories are what actually bring people in. You know, and I've always been reluctant to use stories, even real stories about my encounters, either because it feels like a cheap way of getting attention or because it's a kiss and tell on some interaction I've had, you know, so it's like, oh no, I'll just, not even fictionalize it, but I'll just talk about the idea that I got from that. And in this case, partly because some of these guys really are such fucking assholes, you know, that it's okay to name names. Once you've got $1 billion, you're suffering, you know, from, and you're fair game. You're a public figure. It's a different thing. And even where I didn't name names and told stories, it was also because I see the function of my book is to make people laugh. I want people to be able to laugh at Richard Dawkins' staunch atheism, at Peter Thiel's visions of a water world, seasteading parks, at the tech bros who think they have a software stack for a blockchain that will irrigate the planet, you know, and take care of our agricultural, sexual, psychological, and spiritual needs. Is so catastrophically hubristic that it needs we can't afford to be afraid of these people and their visions. We have to see, oh my God, they are that silly, right? That there's one guy in the book who was worried for me because I've written stories that are questioning question artificial intelligence and whether it's going to work out for us or not. And the guy was like, are you really sure you should be publishing that stuff? Because when the AIs are in charge, they're going to read what you wrote and come after you. And then he told me, this was the really stupid part. He said, I've been avoiding, whenever there's a conversation or something online about AI, I always refrain from sharing what I think so they won't know. And I'm like, if you think AIs are going to be so smart, aren't they going to be able to use statistical analysis to see what you've been selectively avoiding and infer how you feel about them?
You've kind of got more things to worry about at that point than whether you've said something online.
And his jaw drops like,
oh shit, oh man, I didn't think of that, right? Or these guys who are really hadn't considered how do you maintain control of your security staff in your bunker after your money's worthless. It's like they haven't read Machiavelli 101, you know, and they expect to be, you know, dictators of their little worlds.
But can I ask you a question, Douglas? Because, you know, I'm from Eastern Europe and I was brought up in the system that somebody dreamt up around the coffee table and then had the whereabouts to actually force it on, you know, millions of people for quite a number of decades. So in some way, when I read your book, which I loved it, I'm thinking, you know, maybe it's good that they're idiots. Maybe it's good that they're trying to separate themselves and dig bunkers in New Zealand rather than try to put us into bunkers and make us work for them in any more advanced way. So, you know, maybe somehow the escapism, it's a healthier thing for their egos and their masculinity to express itself, because if they were Lenins, they would be after us already. And in some way right. they are, because they're, you know, taking every piece of data they can extract. But it's rather that than having, you know, communist tanks on the lawn, as my mother, my grandmother, and my grandmother had. So yeah. It's a challenge. Should we just, you know, encourage them? The more isolating trend they take, the better for everybody else.
You would think. I mean, we can't for two reasons. One, because their belief that they are going to be able to insulate themselves from the damage they're creating encourages them to do more damage with impunity. You know, so the executive at the Epson printer company who decides that he's going to brick every printer after 5,000 pages in order to force everyone to buy a new printer, he's making the calculation that he's going to make enough money in that planned obsolescence to escape from the damage he's creating by throwing more printers into the landfill. So there's that. And the second part is that they're 0-1 meta understanding of the world ends up conveniently dovetailing with the worst of fascism. You know, so there's a willingness among the tech bro philosophers to do our sense making for us, you know, to sort of do a form of disaster capitalism on the civilizational confusion and say, oh, yes, things are unstable, but come with us. We can make some meta-modern metaphors for you that will hold, you know, your psyche and your consciousness and help you orient and calibrate to this new place. And it's kind of an accelerationist fever dream that they don't realize that they're pulling the language of Ebola and Bannon, and you know, and we see in the woman who was just crowned, you know, princess of the Italian parliament, I hear her speech where she's talking about humans and human autonomy, and I am not a consumer and I am not a number. It's as if she's quoting from my last book, Team Human. Right, because there's that when you try to reacquaint yourself with nature and the self and humanity and human autonomy, if you do it in that abstracted meta way where we're reaching for that goal endpoint fascist thing the way all of the tech bros do, you end up fueling Steve Bannon, so you end up in the same place.
Yeah, it's a difficult place because you mentioned your dislike for virtual reality, but we also aware that the future of the mankind has to be a little bit more limited and restricted, because we just can't keep giving everybody a car and everybody as many goods as we had in the Western countries, because the earth is going to collapse. So what's your take on VR? Because although it could be Ready Player Go, but it could be also a way of creating spaces which we can exercise our creativity and freedom, but to limited impact on the earth. Spending money in virtuality hopefully will be less damaging than spending money outside of it.
So far, it feels more damaging in terms of environmentalism, in terms of the rare earth metals we have to dig up and the infrastructure we have to create, and then all of the Web3 blockchains we've got to, you know, burn. So most of them, it still feels like a very rapid conversion of atoms to bits, you know, and more of the world getting consumed in it. And I also, I don't feel encouraged by any invitation to cede the physical reality for the virtual one. But what I would say, and this is again back to fiction, is yes, every American got to have their own car, and now everyone else is going to want them. But you know, it took a lot of convincing to make Americans even want a car. You used to go to work, you'd operate heavy machinery all day, and then when you're done operating heavy machinery, you would have a beer, get a newspaper, get on a streetcar, and it would take you home with your friends. Then somehow we had to convince people that no, no, after a day of operating heavy machinery, what we want you to do is go sit in another piece of heavy machinery and pay for it and operate that and worry about running people over and then rebuild your entire urban and suburban infrastructure around the needs of this private vehicle. Your beer, your newspaper, your friends are gone. You're in this chariot now, fighting for your life, spending at least one day a week in America. We work to support the vehicle. How is that better, right? So I don't think it's a matter of allowing the rest of the world to have all the crap and nuclear family nightmare that Americans have gotten to experience from the 40s to the 80s until the decline of our civilization, but to assist them in imagining way better pro-social alternatives to the mistakes we made.
Is there not a part of the interest in VR? It's funny that we always find ourselves talking about Ready Player One when we're talking about VR. Yeah. And whether you watch the film or read the book, certainly in the book, you get the setup, the opening piece, which is how that infrastructure got there in the first place. It's like, why do all these sort of areas of the edges of cities actually have kids with that kind of VR kit? And it was there to be their schools. It was there to get them in and give them the education, which they do discuss that setup. I mean, skip that in the book. But there's a part of that piece, and there's a part of what we came through with COVID, where we did suddenly find ourselves now willing to get into Zoom, even though it was an office tool, to be social. And maybe that is the door with which VR gets itself in. Again, it gives us the promise that the early web did: connection, international connection, social connection. Is it survivable, that, the social connection online, without the real human touchiness at scale?
Zoom was a terrific tool for a world in the midst of a global pandemic.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right? That's a good point, yeah.
Which is why, you know, the prisoner's dilemma is a great way of gamifying people in jail. Right? Again, you know, so the premises bother me. You know, so no. I mean, the COVID pandemic was really the main reason I wrote the book I wrote, because I could start to feel, like you're saying, I could start feeling the billionaire survivalist mindset trickling down to me, that I'm finally in a situation where I understand how they feel about other people. Now that other people carry COVID, that's how these billionaires have been feeling about all of us all along. You know, that we are the infectious little masses who are going to, you know, squirm around and mess up their little, you know, machine universe bunker fantasies. You know, they do. I get it. They want to go in Westworld. They want to go into the whatever they call that space where you migrate up into that. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, I understand, you know, he in the real world, what he wants to emulate is Augustus Caesar, right? Which means living at a remove, right? I mean, we should be thankful it's not Caligula, right? It's Augustus is a notch better, right? It's good, but it's still a Holy Roman dictator, right? It's an emperor, right? And that's his hair and all that. And then technologically, when Facebook stops working, it's getting sticky, people are mad, the politicians are angry, the subscriber base is peaking, he wants to go web 2 or web 3 or web 4, you know, so he's going to go meta on this thing. And for him, meta means running around with nothing below the waist, right? There's no, it's not grounded, it's not sexual, it's not intimate, it's this floating free floating thing, you know, and if he wants to go gigazint, you know, as grandma would say, you know, go in good health, but don't bring me or my kids there. I want to be on the ground, my feet on the ground with the soil. You know, they're living out the Francis Bacon fantasy that science and technology will let us take nature by the forelock, hold her down and submit her to our will. Or as even, you know, our friend Terence McKenna would say, rise from the chrysalis of matter into pure consciousness, right? Ugh, you know, no, when I die, maybe, but not now.
Well, it's a shame we couldn't have you here in the real world, in real life. Mm. Right? It is nice to say, but more real events, yeah.
Yeah, and this is virtual reality doing well for us, you know. But when, it was funny, I was on this panel the other day and they asked me, oh, what's the best example you've yet seen of augmented reality? And I said, you know, the best example I've seen is the markings that hobos used to put on trains, on train cars. You know, it was this layer, or the things people used to paint onto houses in the Underground Railroad in the U.S. So you'd know what house is friendly, what house has a dog, who has a gun. So it was a layer on top of our world that gave people information. And it didn't require a headset or new glasses at all.
Just the guide to the book, if you like, the key to the map.
Mm-hmm. Same as graffiti, I guess, to those that can read it, the tagging and all that kind of thing. It's adding a layer of information about a neighborhood that if you know how to read it, you know how to read it. Yeah.
And it's not corporate monopolized. It's an open API.
Not yet. They'll get there. When you were talking there, I was thinking about in terms of what you've done with your book there, in terms of bringing the sort of human stories through. And I feel that the stories we've got in this book are very, so there's a lot of tech and all that sort of stuff, but I think predominantly, if not all of them, have that humanity thing. It's like when humans and tech meet, what could it look like? And I think that feels like possibly the difference about the sort of speculative near future as opposed to some of that space opera, the sort of hard tech sci-fi that's all about the tech, that's all about like what does a spaceship look like, what, and all that kind of thing. This near future stuff seems to be much more about, much more grounded in the life of the humans that will experience it.
In a way, that's why we had quite few women authors in the contribution, because at the moment we don't get to run social platforms yet. It would be very different if we did. But in the meantime, women are very subjected to surveillance in many ways that men are not. So we was just trying to pick it up. You know, the story of a carer that Britta wrote about her having to put a surveillance bracelet on her crazy grandma, and the grandma running away and doing crazy parties. And the recognition between is, I'm a carer, I need to know where she is. But is it really the right technology to bring for the future caring? Like, how are we going to even resolve that? And I'm interested to see what's your view of, you know, if the tech bros were female, would that be any different? Is there hope for the post-male society?
The opportunity, you know, if we want to use the male, female in a kind of a broad stroke, I mean, the opportunity is for a non-climactic, non-catastrophic tech development pathways. What would it be like to develop a technology without an exit strategy?
That's,
you know, where it's leading towards a sustainable outcome. You know, what if you move from the finite game of the sort of male orgasm to the infinite game of the female orgasm, and that was applied to all the narrative, our technological and business narratives? You know, you would break capitalism and you'd break tech brohood. You know, the other interesting thing is, I think you could reverse figure and ground in a profound way. You know, when you're talking about the stories in this book, and I'm thinking about little stories and kind of science fiction anthologies, there's it's beautiful stuff, but you think about like Black Mirror, you know, and all those little stories that he's doing. Each week is another story or two. And they're stories that still end up one way or another centering the technology rather than the human. You know, in each one of these, it's a technology that kind of has gotten out of control in one way or another and then leads to this huge unintended consequence. So it's that same thing. It's going to keep happening. And these stories are different in that they really do take the perspective of the human being, you know, in the technological environment. So there's still a sense of autonomy that goes through these stories where I feel like so much of the, at least the stereotypically white male heterodoxy tech bro model is about controlling the unexpected, controlling the human, making the humans more predictable, getting out of danger. I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe. You know, that's really what they're saying with all of their actions, where I feel like women, having lived through 2,000 or 3,000 years of never being safe, have learned that safety is more than elusive. It's unattainable, right? True safety. The only safety you get is through interhuman trust. So, you know, I think we would be looking at a tech development pathway that is about engendering trust between people rather than substituting for trust with technology. And that would be a fundamentally different approach.
That's a nice one. There's another piece that you mentioned in the introduction that I'd love the opportunity to just challenge you on or ask you about more. And that's you mentioned the short story, because it literally doesn't have time to go through the whole arc and what's going to happen. It is a tableau. You're in, you've got three pages and you're out. And the resilience, I think is the word you use, the resilience that gives to the reader, that, you know, situations can happen and they're messy. They don't start out and build and grow and have resolution. So you just get a quick slice through. I wonder if you could take like just 30 seconds to sort of fill that out again, because it feels like it gives you resilience as a reader to see that the real world is halfway through the story. The real world is the middle of a story, not something with a nice beginning, middle, a climax and an end.
Right. I mean, can you tolerate it is really the question. Can you tolerate it? It's back to the tantra, right? Can you tolerate it? Right. No, no finish, no finish, no finish for you. Just be there. Be here now. It keeps going. It's a never ending story. I mean, I know people that were intolerant of fantasy role playing games. It's like, what do I mean? We come back next week and keep going? It's not done. Yeah, we're going to do this for 5 years, buddy. We're doing this until we go to college. This is like it, right? It's going to keep going. And the people are so they're intolerant of that. It's interesting. It's like the only one way we've been able to do it so far is like these kind of Game of Thrones epic things. At least you get a dragon blowing up a zillion people. You know, you get something to get you through the night, right? You get both, you know, and then and a cliffhanger to get to the next one. But no, we're not tolerant of that, which is why I feel like now we're living in a world where people would rather the world end in a fiery apocalypse than just keep on going in the uncertain way. At least we'll get to the end. You know, who's the sinner? Who's the damned? Who's the winner? Who was right? Is it left? Is it right? Is it God? Is it Satan? Is it, come on. You know, it's like I paid my admission, so I want the thing.
I agree. That sort of notion of living in messiness, randomness being a kind of good thing in your life and all that feels as if that's kind of being washed away, partly through, you know, I get the whole sort of apps to meet people and all the rest of it, but there's a kind of I'm being defined, which, you know, I know we're all easy to define in some ways. That's one of my concerns, is that where's the randomness, where's the messiness, and we have a media that doesn't really play well to that, because they want to be able to do the black and white stuff. And
yeah, it is. And it's a fascist drive. Ultimately, it ends up becoming a fascist drive, because you're either, you know, like the sense making crowd, you're looking for the ultimate metaphor that will finally explain what's going on here. You know, what's a metaphor, right? But to define it. Or if you're in the programmatic mentality, you're looking for the ultimate sequence of algorithms that will incentivize the ideal civilization. How do we build that? Oh, at this, and then you get this many users and that many likes, and it goes around to this, and that will engender the good behavior. So it's always as if there's an answer rather than No, there's no answer. There's the only closest thing we have to an answer is just be nice. Be as nice as possible to other people and living things and stuff as we all struggle through this bizarre, messy, messy reality together.
Which is a brilliant place to end.
Yeah, I think we have to wrap up, but we just wanted to say hello to you from Richard Baybrook, who you mentioned in the book as author of Californian Ideology, which had some influence on the mindset thinking.
Oh, yeah.
So he's waving and he's loving the book. So hopefully we can catch up again in a few months' time. But good luck with the book and thank you so much for supporting for this project. We enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for everything you do. It's an honor to be associated with all of this work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
And that's about where we ended it. That was an event done on Thursday, the 29th of September, with Stephen Oron, Eva Pasco, and Benjamin Greenaway celebrating the publication of their book through Cyber Salon called 22 Ideas About the Future. It's a real nice little collection of super short stories. Each one kind of pops an idea in your head and really doesn't finish, which is kind of part of the fun of it. If you can get used to that kind of open-ended fiction. These are my friends from the early days. One of my very, very first readings, certainly the first reading I did in the UK, was from my book Siberia, 1995. It came out there. And Eva Pasco had opened a cyber cafe called Siberia. So I did my launch of Siberia in London at the Siberia Cafe with Eva Pasco. So it's really a pleasure to show her a solid by promoting this great book that she published with Cyber Salon. Take care, and I'll see you next week.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.